Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Hello and welcome back, if you're coming back, and hello and welcome if it's your first time joining us on Why Would You Tell Me That, a podcast hosted by me, Dave Moore, and him, Neil Delamere, where each week one of us does some research, finds an amazing story, gets an expert, brings the expert along, and then wows the other, and hopefully you as well, with some incredible claim, fact, story, adventure, whatever it is. I can kind of kick back and relax a little bit now because it's Neil Delamere's episode. He's here to tell us what it's all about. Before he does that, I should tell you that we are proudly part of the Acast Creator Network. And thanks to the lads for all their support for us. But Neil, what have you got?
Oh, Dave. Oh, you're going to like this. You and everybody you know who likes to partake of a little tipple of Christmas, particularly at Christmas, called Baileys. We will chat to the South African man, you heard it here, South African, not Irish, who invented Baileys.
You see, what? Like, Baileys strikes me as an ancient thing. I don't even know why there's someone who invented it. And first of all, why someone invented it is not just always a thing like beer. And second of all, how is he alive? Was it not invented like in 11 AD.
You're making it sound like some sort of, if some very gullible tourist listens to this and, yeah. Oh, 'twas Baileys was first handed down by the fairies. It is mixed with the dew from a cromlech and a dolman, stirred by a badger and various different infusions.
Is cromlech a real word?
Cromlech is a real word. That's, I think it's some
I
sort of...
demand that somebody who listens to this podcast either calls either their next dog, goldfish, or child cromlech.
I'm going to look it up while
I want
you're
to
talking.
Meet Cromlech O'Hanlon. I demand...
Cromlech O'Hanlon. What? I mean, Cromlech O'Hanlon, he wasn't the most mobile of junior footballers, but my God, under a high dropping ball into the small parallelogram when he stood just outside. Oh my God. What a superstar Cromlech was.
Cromlech.
And his brother, Passage Grave. Oh. He was so mad. There was Cromlech. Passage Grave was the middle one. Dolman was the girl. And...
Cranog O'Bukla.
Cranog. Oh, God. She was very hard to get. But that's mainly because she lived in the middle of a lake. There was a literal moat around Cranog. A lovely woman. I swear to God, your history teacher from primary school stroke the start of secondary school would be delighted we can remember those.
Yeah,
and for
true.
Any international listener, go and look up all the shit we just talked about.
Best luck spelling it.
A cromlech is a megalithic construction made of large stone blocks. What a legend.
I did not know. You are a legend. I did not have a clue.
So no. Anyway, the point is, Baileys, invented by David Luckman and a druid. No, David Luckman and his business partner and another guy was involved in it as well. David is very keen to give the credit all around, but let's listen to what he has to say because...
Oh, I can't wait.
You're going to agree that he was... absolutely massively important to the entire process, and I'm claiming him as the man who invented it. So
brilliant.
So this week, part one, I thought we'd go food and drink based facts. Okay,
two of my favorite things.
Before we get to them, I want to mention something that we should have done a couple of weeks ago. I found out something that should have stumped Jose Monkey. So if anybody missed it, a couple of weeks ago we had Jose Monkey on, and people send Jose videos that they have filmed, and they say, find me Jose Monkey. And he locates where they shot the video using all sorts of clever logic and internet tools and chicanery and witchcraft and all the rest, right? I should have sent him a picture of you or me in front of Rose Cottage, Dave.
Rose Cottage?
Rose Cottage. It is a quintessential Cotswolds, beautiful stone cottage, right? And the second you see this, you think the bucolic, rolling English countryside and hills and people in tweed looking conservative.
I was just about to say then, if it is so quintessentially Cotswolds, you're not just giving Jose the answer.
Well, you are and you aren't, because I mean, it's made out of the local stone, it has all the local features of Cotswolds architecture, and it was, and that is the clue here, in the village of Chedworth. Now it is in Michigan.
Ooh, like stone by stone job.
Stone by stone, my friend.
Oh man, that's good.
Henry Ford moved it.
Stop it, Henry Ford.
Yeah, all the way across the Atlantic Ocean, and he had to hire the best stone skimmers in all of the world
to make it all 3,000 miles
plus the extra bit to Michigan. No, it's a very flat cottage. It's the only way he was hit. All the stones were very flat, like flint. That's how he got across the Atlantic.
That's phenomenal. Like Henry Ford, like we've had varying reports on that fella. Like by and large, I think we can assume he wasn't the greatest human that's ever lived. However, he did some weird and kind of vaguely wonderful things alongside some of the darker stuff. But like do you remember we told you about Fordlandia? I told you that. Yeah. But we're doing the rubber heist back in, I think it was season 4.
Yeah, so he tried to get rubber from
Brazil in the plantations. And he designed a town built exclusively around this. And one of the things he banned, he liked banning things. One of the things he banned for the Brazilian workers was football. And I mean, the lads just went, mate, this just isn't happening. And they just tore the place asunder because
he was mad into square dancing as well, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Well, he loved the Cotswolds, right? So this is the background to it from going on holidays there. And he knew the world was changing, thanks in large part to his own Model T creation, essentially. Yep. So he wanted to preserve certain things, right? Like Edison's labs and the Wright brothers' shop, right? So he got his English agent to source a house. The aforementioned Rose Cottage.
Rose Cottage, okay.
Bought it for about £500. I've seen differing reports. £500. I've seen $5,000 for the land and the house, right? And the agent was told to drive around and source a cottage which with as many of those original features as possible. So he would go to these, and the Cotswolds, the villages, particularly in those days, were quite distant from one another. So it took a long time to do this. Found this cottage. It has native limestone. That's what it's constructed from. It has a nice doorway. It has mullions to the windows and aged, mellowed drip stones. That's
oh my
what
God.
Said back to him.
I trusted that you were devoted enough to this podcast that you've spent so long researching that you know these words off by heart. But please tell me that you're managing somehow to read these while you're talking to me, because that the way you described mullions there was too involved.
I've just watched too much Dermot Bannon and Room to Improve, and oh my God, I'm a sucker for some tasty mullions. Once someone puts a mullion onto the barbecue, a pork mullion, lovely. Bit of honey glaze on the outside of it.
Delicious.
Now, he said, I want this. I want this. And I want this to be brought to Michigan. So now, you could argue here, and I don't know how you feel about this, but he wanted other kind of classic Cotswold architecture stuff put on it. Oh. So he also added features like a porch, which is a copy of another one.
Or which wouldn't have been on the Rose Cottage initially.
No, and a dormer window and a bay window and a beehive oven. That would be on other houses.
Okay.
Maybe possibly of different classes, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
But they're all examples of Cotswold architecture, I suppose. Keystones were numbered. Stones were packed into 506 sacks.
Wow.
Doors, windows, staircases, beams packed into a further 211 crates. He even brought sheep to add to this kind of storybook cottage view.
Hang on, you mean live sheep?
Live sheep, yeah. It's a famous.
He wasn't happy with Michigan sheep. He had to bring Cotswoldian sheep.
Cotswold sheep, yeah. It's a particular breed there, and which is one of the reasons that Cotswolds were so rich for so many years, and from the Middle Ages onwards, because it was all based on wool. And he got all this stuff to Michigan. Took 67 railway wagons to transport almost 500 tons of material from
Foss so
Cross
rich.
Station to Brentford.
He was so rich.
Yeah, I mean, this is just bonkers, isn't it? He was just so rich. And then he got Ford workers from the factories. They supplied the labour.
Yeah.
But he got local stonemasons from the Cotswolds, Tom Troughton and...
Oh, he brought those lads over.
Yeah. William Ratcliffe. And they were... You know, you lads, you know what you're doing. Put this back together.
Yeah.
You know when you do anything from IKEA and there's two or three screws left over? 506 sacks. And apparently they didn't have stuff left over and they're like, oh, I don't know what the fuck. Well, I don't know
yeah, so trying to stuff that into your back pocket as you walk out after a day. Yeah, no, it's all there now, yeah.
Yeah, it's like that bit in, what is it, The Great Escape? Where they have to put the clay down the trousers.
Shawshank
the two stone
Redemption.
Maces. Yeah. No, it's definitely The Great Escape. Is that the Shawshank Redemption as well?
Shawshank Redemption, definitely that's where I know it from.
Oh, okay.
He shakes it down his boots, yeah.
There's stonemasons doing the same thing in both of those films. And then they were treated, the old stonemasons, they'd made a good few bob from it, by the way. They were treated to a little Niagara Falls sojourn before they went home. So, yeah.
Sounds mildly threatening. It's like, you're making that sound like it's some kind of a mob hit. And before they went home, so that there was no evidence, they were treated to a Niagara Falls sojourn, which is like basically they're wrapped up and thrown over the edge.
They contacted the Irish man who was a house cleaner who cleaned the newly built house. And you make it sound like, you know, when there's and he was the greatest pharaoh that Egypt ever had.
Yeah.
And the design was so beautiful, he blinded the architect. No, it's not that sinister. That's where the sacks went missing. Here, lads, there's your flotation device for the Niagara River, blah 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 blah.
Cotswold stone dragging them down.
Yeah, no. It is still visited by millions and millions of people in Michigan as we speak. So let's get back to food and drink because we're talking about Bailey's.
Oh yeah, yeah.
I was getting an X-ray in the orthodontist the other day, David.
Right.
Okay. The only non-teenage girl in the dentist. That made me feel very manly. Let me tell you. And you see, I always think Americans and Irish teeth are like our idealized boundaries. This is my theory.
Right.
Like, they're all about white picket fences, you know, which are straight and white and even and uniform.
Yeah.
And we have hedges. or dry stone walls, if you're in the West.
Yes,
like, they're broken, uneven, gaps where you've been kicked by a cow. You know, it's a similar thing, right?
Moss growing on them. I know exactly what you mean.
Moss growing. You never see anybody flossing a wall. Why would you do it with your teeth? So there's a sign showing how radioactive that the X-ray would be in the dentist.
Yeah, of course.
And it had the scale of radioactivity. So it said, like, dental X-ray is X and a full X-ray is this and shifting Spider-Man is this and licking the ground in Chernobyl is this. But at the top was banana.
Banana and radioactivity.
A banana is radioactive.
There it is. I remember this. Something about this.
They are rich in potassium. One of the natural isotope variants is potassium 40, which is radioactive. And a lorry full of bananas is radioactive enough to trigger a false alarm on a radiation detector.
No way. So if I had a Geiger counter and was walking around clicking and I walked past a truck of bananas.
Mm.
How did the lads in Fife get on with their lives?
Yeah, a well-provisioned monkey would set off the a Geiger counter in Dublin Airport if they have one. But a typical adult human contains around 140 grams of potassium, of which about 16 milligrams, I think it's milligrams, is potassium 40. So you are 280 times more radioactive than a banana. So
I am.
Yeah, you. Well, you in particular.
Oh,
you're like the Hulk.
Cool.
Yeah.
I like that.
Eating one increases your total amount of potassium 40 by about 0.4%, which is detectable,
right,
but it's very temporary because your metabolism just fixes it.
This isn't, you know, a groundbreaking fact because I'm bringing it to you in your part one, but
yeah,
you do know. Have you ever seen a monkey open a banana?
Like,
yeah,
it's my kink. That's what I like watching.
Of all of them.
Do it slowly, King Kong.
No, but that's the thing, they don't. So, like, because bananas grow, as we know, like, they grow in bunches, and the stalky bit is the bit where it's connected to the
bunch.
The bunch, exactly. But it's the other end that we treat as, in inverted commas, the bottom of the banana.
Yeah.
Is the bit that grows out. That's the front of the banana. It's like we go around to every car and we just opened the boot. Just like open the bonnet, for God's sake.
And I mean, they are the banana experts, you'd have to say.
Yeah. They just pinch it.
Yeah.
And then it just peels away. There's that thing for years, and that old wives' tale of like, don't eat the bottom bit of the banana, it'll make you sick. There's a little bit at the bottom. That's a bit at the top of the banana. And if you pinch it and peel it, that bit's gone. So it's not going to make you sick because it's not there anymore.
But if bananas are radioactive and humans are radioactive,
Do
you remember Banana Man, the cartoon?
Oh, do I ever?
Surely he was like Fukushima now at this point. Like he was beyond Spider-Man levels of radioactive.
Can you remember A, his name? And B, his address.
I cannot remember either of those things, but I can still quote Hamlet from the Leaving Cert. Is that any use to you?
Yeah, but
what was his name?
No. Therein lies the difference between Neil Delamere and Dave Moore. I could not quote you a single thing from Shakespeare, having done the Leaving Cert as well. I think I did King Lear. Out Vile Jelly might be the only thing I can say.
How can you not remember any Shakespeare? I mean, he was your contemporary. This is an absolute disgrace.
Ongoing assassination of my character, of Enola. Anyway, his name was Eric.
Was it Baker Street, but another?
No, it was Acacia Avenue.
Oh, very impressive.
Now, I think I'm going to go out on a limb here and think it was Eric lived at 54 Acacia Avenue.
No,
are you
Googling it?
Okay, look it up. How close am I with Eric?
When's the last time you saw it now?
Banana Man. In the 80s. I just remember Eric lived at 54 Acacia Avenue. And he was very ordinary or something like that until he became Banana Man.
Oh my good lord.
Whoa.
In the cartoon, Eric Wimp. A boy magically transforms into a banana man, an adult superhero, when he eats a banana.
Wait. Can I change? I haven't looked it up. Can I change my number?
What did you say?
I said 54. I'm thinking it was a 20.
Yeah.
I want to say 24 Acacia Avenue. Anyway, 20 something. I don't know.
29 Acacia Road.
Road. Oh no, I got the road. Oh, that's because I live on an avenue now. I'm kind of mildly disappointed. You were impressed, but I'm disappointed. Eric Wimp, 29 Acacia Road.
I kind of enjoy it more that you try to explain the rationality of the decision. Oh, I live on a road. And
I live on an avenue now. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Eric eats a banana, something, transformation occurs. Oh.
Yeah, and he becomes Banana Man.
All right, sorry about that. This is completely distracting from your food and drink talk.
It's okay. I'll give you a quick one and then a slightly longer one, okay?
Yeah.
Have you ever heard of a Connie Dodger?
No, I have not.
Connie Dodger. I just love this. Cornelius Lucy was the Archbishop of Cork, right?
Right.
In the 50s and the 60s and the 70s and about 30 years. Stickler for Lent and the rules of Lent.
Right.
And I know you're very suspicious about all this other stuff, you know, as an atheist. So, If you remember back, it was a big thing here.
Sorry, it still is, even with children who are not in any way religious, like my own, they don't ever end up giving anything up, but they still go, oh, it's Lent, I'm going to do this, I'm going to not do anything.
One meal and two collations used to be the rule, right? The collations were like a little mini meal, I suppose, a biscuit with your tea sort of thing, right? And he was very strict on this sort of stuff. And, you know, they carried a lot of weight back in those days. But he didn't say what size biscuit.
Oh.
So a local bakery in Cork used to make these massive biscuits. Like massive.
One biscuit with your tea.
Yeah, and you could get around all the rules. And he was Cornelius or Connie.
Brilliant.
So it's called the Connie Dodger.
Oh, that's so good. I love it.
I thought you'd like that.
That is amazing.
You're not going to like this one as much.
Oh.
I'll tell you that right now. This is our last food and drink fact.
Okay.
It will put you off. The vanilla flavouring in your baked goods. You like baked goods?
Love baked goods, flavoured anything. Yes.
Okay,
love it.
So in your baked goods and your sweets and all the rest could come from the anal excretions of beavers.
I mean, when you said you're not going to like this, I didn't think we were going to go to beaver anus. Like, that's not what I thought.
Why? I mean, it's my go-to.
I should know at this stage. Season 5.
Yeah.
What?
So,
Why is vanilla not from vanilla pods?
Well, because the hoop of a beaver, not technically not the hoop, secretes this kind of goo.
Yeah.
It's a scientific term called castoreum. And they use it to mark the territory. And the US FDA, you know, the Food and Drink Administration,
says
that it's generally regarded as safe. Generally is a bit of a worry there. Generally regarded as safe as an additive.
Probably not safe if you're trying to get it out of a live beaver, I suggest.
Well, we're getting on.
No.
Milking of the beaver.
The extraction of the anal gland, but go on.
Well, it's been used extensively in perfumes and foods.
Right.
For 8 years, and that was according to a study in 2007,
right,
in the International Journal of Toxicology. So I mean, it's nearly 20 years since then. So it's the guts of 100 years in perfumes. Like, you've never seen that in a perfume ad. You know the way perfume ads are always French, and it's always pretentious, and it's always black and white. It's "I will not be who they want me to be." Sometimes the soul does not live in the part of the attic where the water tank is. It stays. I want it to be in the hot breast of the mind. Givenchy. I want to see one where your man goes, "Chanel number 5, made from the stuff from a badger's or beaver's anus."
I think as a marketing tool, think saying, "Look, mate, this thing smells like a beaver's anus." I think it is definitely worth trying. It might ruin the house of Givenchy, but it's worth trying.
It comes from the castor sacs, basically, which are located
between... None of this is making it any better, Neil.
Well, it's not from the bottom, shall we say. It's...
Oh, great. Let me guess. Is there a way of getting to the castor sacs without going through the bottom?
Well, they're located between the pelvis and the base of the tail, but because of its close proximity to the anal glands, castoreum is often a combination of castor gland secretions, anal gland secretions, and urine. And they have to anesthetize the animal and then milk its nether region.
Surely to frick, it would be easier and cheaper and less ridiculous to just scrape the bloody seeds out of a vanilla pod and give us that.
Do you think that if you go into one of these very high-end French perfume houses, that it's like, do you know the bit in The Matrix where you just open a door and there's just all these beavers bent over, arse in the air, "Don't look at me! Don't look at me!" And all these French, the people with the smallest hands in. That's why there's a French manicure, because you have to get your nails done after you've milked a beaver.
So bad.
And
wait. Is that then the difference of vanilla extract, vanilla essence? Is there some... I don't know.
You could plug a badger into a Glade plug-in? I couldn't get my hands in the beaver, but we decided to do this instead. Or if you ever got into a car, if you ever got into a car like in rural Canada, and instead of an air freshener, they had a beaver hanging from the rear view mirror, just squeeze my tail if you need a fresh burst.
I prefer the bits when you were talking about old cartoons we liked. I like Banana Man. He didn't smell like a beaver's anus.
Do you want to know what the worst bit of this is?
Oh, how can it be any worse than it already is?
Because you don't have to list it on the ingredient list, so you can't. What? You can't look up.
You can put beaver anus in something and not tell people. Stop the world! I want to get off.
No, so because of it, so let's assume this is America specifically, because of its FDA label.
Yeah.
In some cases, manufacturers don't have to list it, and they just refer to it sometimes as natural flavoring.
Holy Jesus.
I mean, which is worse? The idea of you milking the beaver who is knocked out, thankfully, or a line of beavers. You know, when a dog has worms in it, wipes his bum on the carpet, like beavers just rubbing their bottom on
said no. Neither of these pictures is something I need in my life, no, nor does anyone
great,
else.
It's not great. But it is vaguely related to food and drink, and that's what we're going to talk about in the second half.
Okay.
With a man with a greater sense of decorum and indeed a greater contribution to the world of food and drink than the nonsense that I have just told you.
Thankfully.
We're going to talk to David Gluckman, one, if not the man behind the invention of Baileys.
Wow.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive and June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive and June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Welcome back to part two of Why Would You Tell Me That? Now, normally at this point, if we were looking at the invention of Baileys, Dave, I'd have a scientist lined up or I'd have a historian who specializes in food and drink social history, and they would be brilliant. They always are. However, I'm going to go one better.
Oh.
I have them, well, one of the actual people who invented Baileys.
Oh, my God.
Yes. I am delighted to say we're joined by David Gluckman, inventor of Baileys, amongst other people, and author of a great book about his adventures coming up with new drinks. He's come up with a load of them. The book is called That Shit Will Never Sell, which proved to be wrong. David Gluckman, how are you?
I'm very good, thank you. Great to be here.
So, I mean, it's been a massive success since 1973 when it was invented. We'll get to that a little bit later. But how did you end up inventing Baileys? Like, it's 1973. You're marketing men. You're Don Draper type lads. What were you tasked with in it exactly?
Well, it was very strange. It was a very simple brief. And it wasn't something which somebody said, if you don't solve it, we're going to kill you. It was nothing like that. Somebody said, it started with the Irish finance minister. I can't remember his name. But he talked to the head of Gilby's of Ireland, who was a great man called David Dand. And he said that if you develop a brand that is primarily for export and brings export money into Ireland, we will give you a 10-year tax holiday.
Wow.
Okay.
So in other words, if it's successful, you don't pay tax on it for 10 years. And this kind of went from Dublin across to London, where the head office was, to a guy I worked with, and then onto my desk. And it was simply, please develop an Irish drink for export, period. That was it. That was the brief. We had no idea who the end user was going to be, but that was the brief. And I remember it came in on a Friday afternoon. We just opened up in business on our own. And I said to my partner on Monday morning, what are we going to do about this Irish brief? And he was a great man, but he would switch off completely for the weekend. He had to be totally rebooted on Monday morning. So he said, what Irish brief? I explained it to him. And then I'll go back to the origins of the idea, which are quite important. In the 60s, I worked in an advertising agency in London, and one of our clients was a very famous Irishman at the time called A.J.F. O'Reilly.
Tony O'Reilly,
yes. He's quite an old, he's old, a bit older than me now. And he came to the agency with the brief to transform Irish butter from a commodity, which commanded a very low price, to a brand,
wow,
which commanded a premium price, and that made a huge difference to the Irish economy. It was a fantastic thing to work on because it wasn't like selling soap. It was trying to bring money into an economy. And O'Reilly was an incredibly charismatic man to work with and also a great man at buying ideas, which is a rare talent. Anyway, going forward in time to 1973, in Dean Street in London, I said to my partner, what are we going to do about this Irish brief? He looked at me quizzically and then said, and I said, do you think there's anything in my Kerrygold background which we might bring to bear on this? And he said, well, what happens if we mix Irish cream and Irish whiskey? And I said, well, there's only one way to find out. Let's go down to the shop, buy some whiskey, buy some cream, bring it back to the office and see what it tastes like.
And?
I mean, we had no technical skills at all. We had no idea whether cream and whiskey were comfortable bedfellows in a bottle. But we figured we'd better try something. So we went down to the shops, bought some stuff, brought it back up to the office, mixed it up a bit. I mean, I could give you no idea what the dimensions, the
proportions
were.
Yeah.
And well, it tasted disgusting. It really tasted awful. So I said, no, there's something here. I'm convinced. Let's go back to the shop. So we went back to International Stores in Berwick Street in London and looked around, and I found a can of Cadbury's drinking chocolate. So I said, that looks interesting. So went back to the office, added the drinking chocolate, put a bit of sugar in, mixed and matched, tasted it, and it tasted pretty good. And it had been transformed.
So we just glossed over something simple there. David Luckman was part of the team that invented Kerrygold, essentially.
Like, yeah, I was thinking the same thing.
I was very junior.
Still. Your modesty knows no bounds, but you invented literally something that has now traveled the globe and made this country so much money.
You might have put the tire on the space shuttle, but you were working on the space shuttle, David. That's what we're saying here. So we got these two, like, you're not misfits, but in terms of what Irish people would assume the inventors or the people who came up with the idea of Baileys, you've got a South African of Jewish heritage and possibly the poshest English man that there's ever been, your partner, Hugh, who is, sounds absolutely class if you read the book. We'll get to why Baileys is called Baileys in a second, but one of the reasons was because they were moving within Soho, Dave, and yeah. Hugh insisted that their new offices be near a good game butcher's.
Butcher's?
He liked his grouse. Isn't that right, David?
He did. He certainly did.
This was an Oxford-educated Etonian posh dude, and because they moved around within Soho, they had to come up with this idea for this concoction. We'll get to that in a second, though, right? So anyway, you create this concoction, David. it begins to taste good now at this point with the sugar and the Cadbury's. Well, and
maybe everything. The fact that you're three glasses in, is everything starting to taste good? Who knows?
But what else did you notice anything else about it?
Well, it tasted stronger than it was, although if you asked me what the ABV was, I wouldn't have been able to tell you. There was just something about it that got me going, and we decanted some into a cleaned-up Schweppes tonic bottle, screw-cap bottle, and we just started off in business, so we didn't have to go to work in suits in those days. We could go in jeans. So I said, look, I'm going to go over to IDV, the head office in Yorkgate, and I put on my suit. I said to Hugh, do you want to come with me? So he said, no. He said that these people are only interested in real drinks like malt whiskey or fine wines. He said they won't be by that Mickey Mouse idea. So I said, okay, I put my suit on, jumped in the cab, went across to York Gate on the edge of Regent's Park and met my client and friend, a wonderful man called Tom Jago. He was a Cornishman originally, and he was a very bright guy, and I walked into his office with this ridiculous screw cap Schweppes bottle, poured it out into a glass, and we tasted it. And he said, that's great. I think we should do it. I said, can you? He said, no idea, but let's give it a try. And I think thereby hangs the tale, really, that an idea is only as good as the guy who's paying for it says it is. You can have the best idea in the world, but if the guy you're selling it to thinks it's rubbish.
Well, that's fair. And he also has to reverse engineer it now based on a Schweppes bottle of this liquid and presumably figure out how do we manufacture this on a much bigger scale.
How do we manufacture it at all?
Yeah.
But they had guys up in Harlow in Essex who were the technical people. What we did was about 3 or 4 days later, took it up to Harlow to the technical guys and said, can you make this? And they said, no idea. But they'd give it a try. I mean, they were required to do that. And I remember talking to Mac McPherson, who was the genius behind the liquid, about 10 years later. And I said, what did you really think of the stuff we brought to you? He said, I thought it was absolutely disgusting.
This was 5 days after they made it, and it's been sitting in a bottle.
It's been sitting in a bottle,
exactly.
I don't
think bottle age did it any favours. But he said, on the plus side, he said, but I know what you're trying to do.
Okay.
And I can do rather better.
I mentioned that you moved offices and that relates to the name. What happened there?
Well, when I worked with Tony O'Reilly back in the 60s, he said to me one day in a conversation, if you ever come up with an Irish brand that needs a family name, don't pick one like mine. In other words, O'Reilly's Irish Cream.
Yeah.
He said sounded whimsical.
Okay.
And so that stuck in my, I think ideas are that like lots of bits and pieces that stick in your brain and then they come out almost to order. You know, fueled by panic and fear and everything else. And so O'Reilly said, you know, don't pick O'Reilly or McGillicuddy's Irish Cream or whatever it is.
Yeah.
Something different. We were moving office to Greek Street, which is two streets down from where Bailey's was born. And there was a restaurant below our new office called Bailey's Bistro. Ah. And I thought, that's it. I don't know. I mean, I think sometimes, often with ideas, you come to a conclusion and it becomes a kind of fanatical belief.
Yes. You're not even sure how you got there necessarily, but just it has to be Bailey.
Well, I knew how I got there, you know, in hindsight, because O'Reilly sort of pointed me in that direction.
He said use a kind of an Anglo-Irish name, didn't he? It's not as whimsical as the O'Reilly.
Yeah, something like that.
So you still got a sort of a Bailey's effort, if that fits the mold. But talking of molds, you didn't want to spend money molding bottles, did you, at the start?
No. Well, we had no idea whether the idea would work. So what we did was we found a Redbreast bottle. And Tom, my client, who was quite handy, managed to design a letter B to go over the R on the neck of the bottle.
So, oh, right. So redbreast bottles have the ore.
Well, they had then.
Yeah. Okay.
We figured it was going to be a liqueur in a short, fat, brown bottle. That was just our preconception at the time. It wasn't a sort of burning conviction.
Mm.
It seemed like a good idea at the time. So that became Bailey's. Tom was great. I called him up and said, let's call it Bailey's. He said, great, perfect. he could have said, well, why haven't you looked at 16 other names?
Yeah.
He just bought the instinct, which was amazing, really.
Is it true you just made up the address on the early bottles?
Well, what we did was, it was one of my better contributions, I think. I said, look, we're going over to Dublin to meet people we've never met before. We're going over with one idea, so we've got no plan B. Now, this is a pretty wacky idea in terms of the booze business. Why don't we print the labels up? So we actually printed labels and put them on the bottle and dressed the bottle so they looked real rather than some kind. You know, back in those days, you didn't have computers. So,
of course,
there was no beautiful computer-generated design. There was magic marker roughs, which looked pretty rough. So we actually did had a printed label put onto a bottle and made it look great so that when we handed it to them, it was something they could see and touch and taste and hopefully believe in.
And what was the reaction in Dublin then? Because, you know...
Can I take you there?
Oh, please. I'm along for every bit of the ride, yes.
Well, a couple of gentle stops on the way. So one of the things was market research was a fairly new thing in those days. And we just discovered this whole notion of focus groups.
All right.
So I said, why don't we stick Bailey's into a couple of focus groups and see what people think of it? And that was actually a mistake. But
why?
What did they say?
Well, because we didn't know anything about focus groups. So in the male group, one guy said, look, this is a girl's drink. I wouldn't be seen dead drinking it in public.
Okay.
And of course, all the other guys, they're not going to say, no, I disagree with you.
Yeah.
They all went along with him. So that didn't go down too smoothly. And then in the female group, one woman said it reminded her of kaolin and morphine, which was a sort of diarrhea remedy back in the 70s.
No.
So that was a bit of a downer.
Yes.
And so the report came out saying, interesting idea, but maybe not. And I remember picking it up on the day we drove to Dublin to make the presentation. There was this document, and I thought, reading it on the plane, it wasn't going to infuse anybody. So I put it back in my briefcase and didn't
mention it. Brilliant.
He just buried the market research. And then what was it, like 10 years later when it was a massive success, or 15 years later when it was a massive success, David read it out at a party.
Yeah, the 10th anniversary party.
Oh, fabulous. But,
there was that. But the other thing is we put a couple of bottles into a pub in London. In fact, I was thinking about it earlier, and I don't think the people in the pub who are in there now have any idea of the story, but this is quite near IDV's head office, the parent company's head office. And I would call in every couple of days and say, anybody bought any yet? Absolutely not. Bottles just stained there, gathering dust. And then just, I think, 2 days before we went to Dublin, I went in and one of the bottles was gone. So I said, oh, what happened? He said, oh, two policemen came in last night and drank the whole bottle between them.
What?
So, I mean, once you get a taste for it, you go for it.
Well, that was showtime, really. I thought, you know, we now have incontrovertible evidence that Bailey's is going to be a worldwide winner.
Apparently, the early bottle said the Dairy Distillery, County Monaghan, because it sounded good, Dave. David Gluckman
just made it up. That's all.
Brilliant.
He just made it up because he thought it sounded good.
County Monaghan.
Like you said, it's as important for the people. Like, you can come up with this idea if Tom Jago in London and then the lads in Dublin who are the guys who are going to be making this, who would have to invest in a plant. If they don't buy the idea, you're gone. Can I ask you how much money
I was going to ask the same question. I assume David Gluckman is an absolute billionaire because of this.
How much money did I get out of the Baileys?
Yeah.
Well, I'll tell you exactly what we got. And it's not much. I think we got paid £3,000.
Oh, my God. Really?
I think we were being paid a fee of £1,000 a month to come manage up with the business. So right. I think we worked out it was about £3,000, which we got for Baileys.
And do you ever feel like you were more deserving of a percentage of all of the Bailey sales globally?
No, not really. I mean, I think had we owned the patent to the technology, you know, we just did a good job. I mean, in a way, you know, we were never penalized if something failed.
Okay.
So we did a good job and it turned out to be a great job. And
but it's just, it is amazing to me, the two, you know, marketing guys, ad guys, in that time in London are tasked with creating, you know, a chemical product, as it were, a product that is, you know, as you had to go to IDV and find the experts who could then, you know, engineer it. But you were still tasked with creating this brand new out of nowhere drink. And you, I don't know if you meant it, but you found a niche in this, in the market. Like, were you aware of the drinks market from that point of view? You knew where to look.
Well, we knew what the drinks market, you know, we'd had a 3 or 4 years experience working in the market up to then. And we knew a bit about the market, but we knew this was a different idea. And I suppose I thought to myself, well, why should all drinks not taste very nice? Mm. You know, back in those days, whiskey, gin, vodka, they didn't taste too great. There was no reason why somebody shouldn't create a drink which actually tasted pretty scrumptious, and that's what...
Yeah, I must say, from a personal point of view, my wife is, to this day, supporting Baileys in this country that we live in because she absolutely loves a Baileys with ice and will, you know, at the weekend, finish off a lovely meal and go, do you know what I'm going to have now? I'm going to have a Baileys with ice. And she even has a little bottle, I think it's a little fox's head that sits on top of it, a very ornate bottle that she only puts Baileys in. So thank you, David, for making her a very happy lady on the weekends.
I imagine Tom Jago getting that initial bottle going, this is going to cause murder at Christmas parties all over the land and also make an excellent cheesecake. That's all I'll say. David, do you know how many bottles have been sold?
Oh, over 2 billion.
2 billion?
By 2019, 2 billion bottles.
Wow.
Yeah, and I remember... There's a thing in my book, is I think I've got a headline somewhere saying, has the Pope ever had a Baileys? I wondered, you know, so many bottles, so many glasses.
Surely.
Time. But there were some interesting side stories to it, I think. One of them was about 6 months before we launched, I had a call from David Dand. I remember it must have been sometime in early July or late June, because the Open Golf was on. And he called me up. He said, look, we can't just call it Baileys. We have to give it an initial. What shall we give it? So I said, well, and I was looking at the paper, and there was something about RNA talk about pin placements
right
for the Open Golf. So I said, oh, why don't we give it two initials? Let's call it RNA Bailey. Yeah. And bless him, David Dunn said, yeah, I love it. Let's do it.
Oh, that creates such an image of a family drink honed over generations, like in Monaghan in this fake dairy place, but really it came out of the RNA. That's brilliant.
Can you tell us where the title of your book comes from? That Shit Will Never Sell. That relates to Baileys, doesn't it?
It does indeed. What happened was Baileys was launched in Taylor's Hall in Dublin in 1974, sometime in November. I can't remember the exact date. And it was a great party, and we were told to keep quiet and sit in the back and not say anything, which we were quite happy to do. And the CEO of IDV then was a man called Anthony Tennant, who later became knighted. And he took some bottles over to New York to IDV's guy in New York, an industry legend called Abe Rosenberg. And he said, I've got this new drink. I'd like you to try it. So Abe looked over the bottle, which he said reminded him of Vietnam fatigue uniforms. because of the kind of khaki green color on the original bottle. And then he tasted it and looked Mr. Tennant, as was, in the eye and said, "That shit will never sell."
Wow.
I thought, what a great title for a book.
Oh, amazing.
Yeah. And that's become one of the, it's a sort of, it's been written up in loads of books. It's a lot of people remember it.
So, David, do you indulge in a bit of Baileys yourself? Is it something you'd buy if you were passing it in the supermarket and go, "I'll have a glass of that of an evening"?
Absolutely not. No, I always have Cool Swan.
Cool Swan, another
Cool
one of your
Swan
drinks,
is
I
far
presume.
Superior.
Ah, brilliant.
Yeah, that answers your question, Dave Moore. You know, are you emotionally attached? God, no. I just move on to the next project. I never look behind me. Always. He's like the Terminator of ideas. He's John Draper mixed with the Terminator. On to the next project. Think about that. 1974, in May, Hugh and David have this idea. What we throw a bit of cream into whiskey, and by November, as you say, it's being launched. That's how quickly it could happen there. It's just amazing. And then 2 billion bottles later, here we are, all thanks to Hugh and to David and to Tom Jago and Mac McPherson, as he mentioned there as well, who reverse engineered their concoction. David Gluckman, it's been an absolute pleasure to talk to you today. And people, I've been leafing through the book. He worked on loads of brands. He worked on Sheridan's and Tanqueray Gin and Distilled Guinness was the other one. It's called That Shit Will Never Sell. Just check it out. It's really, really interesting. Thanks, David.
Thank you both very much. Enjoyed it.
Absolutely amazing.
Welcome back to part three of Why Would You Tell Me That? Well, Dave, that's a classic Christmas and other time of the year table, Baileys, invented certainly in part by a South African man.
Well, look, here's what I was saying in the chat with him is that, like, it's one of my wife's, you know, favorite things. And Baileys anything to me tastes amazing. Baileys cheesecake, Baileys, the chocolates they make out of the Baileys coffees that people get, like, such a delectable, brilliant thing. And I just love his description of inventing it in London as an ad agent. Like, it's just phenomenal.
You do, like we said, you do kind of think of this as a factory-based process. Two lads, one South African, one very posh English dude going, what happens if we horse a load of cream into a load of Irish whiskey and go
and then
from there?
Add some sugar and see what happens. Yeah, it's fascinating. Yeah. Honestly, fascinating. I would listen to him talk for days.
And if Baileys want to sponsor future episodes, clearly Dave is so into it that that would be a marriage made in heaven.
Oh,
so
yeah.
I've given you the origin of Baileys, which was not, as you suggested, at the start of the episode, some sort of druidic.
No, it wasn't as ancient as I thought it was, as an ice dispenser. Well, I'm actually, for the next episode, I'm actually going to go origin as well. And I don't, you know, sometimes we do kind of cross. Now, it's not, don't worry, it's not food or drink.
Okay.
But in the next episode, I will tell you about the first ever road trip and the woman behind it, Neil. The woman behind it.
Ooh, that is good. You have. Yeah. Consider my interest piqued.
Right. Well, check that out next time. And why would you tell me that with me and him? See ya.
Bye.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.